Did you see that thing Battle Frankie posted after last week's episode?
Which one?
A lot of people post a lot of things.
The
normalized human time when you like compare one clock cycle in a CPU at 3 gigahertz to like 1 second of real world time.
Yeah, that thing was very eye-opening, let's say.
I understood this, I thought, but this illustrates it in the best way I've ever seen.
Yeah, I knew all that stuff intuitively, but to see it quantified is a very different thing. Why don't you explain exactly what we're talking about?
Yeah, here? It's hard to understand like what a nanosecond, how a nanosecond relates to a, say a microsecond, right? So yeah. On a 3 gigahertz clock cycle, one clock cycle takes about 0.3 of a nanosecond. So that's 0.3 billionths of a second, I guess. And if you normalize that to 1 second, then accessing the level one cache of the one that's built into the CPU takes 3 seconds. The level two cache takes 9 seconds. And the level three cache takes 43 seconds, which is bonkers. Like, yes, that's the big thing that we were talking about on the chiplet that holds the whole thing together. How accessing RAM, which takes between 70 and 100 nanoseconds, depending on the clock speed and latency of your RAM, would be equivalent to 3.5 to 5.5 minutes. So it's like,
that was the part where my eyes flew wide open. Like, right. The cache stuff makes sense. It's like, yeah, okay, sure, the level three cache is going to take a good number of clock cycles to, because that's the slowest one, of course. Yeah. But then once we hit the RAM one, and I was like, wait, system RAM's supposed to be very fast, right? Like, that's the fastest thing outside of the CPU in the computer.
Yeah.
But this normalized figure being like 5 minutes to access was...
Yeah, so like the CPU wants something, it's in physical RAM on the motherboard, on, you know, in the chips that you socket into your motherboard, and like it has to wait the equivalent of 5 minutes to get the answer back. That's bananas.
It's wild. Well, keep going.
It gets worse. To access an NVMe SSD IO, which is usually about between 7 and 150 microseconds, that's the equivalent of 2 hours to 2 days.
That's a long time.
It's like getting a letter. a rotational disk IO.
Oh, you mean a hard drive?
A hard drive. 1 to 10 milliseconds of computer time is equivalent to 11 days to 4 months.
That's
Pony Express, man.
If that, maybe carrier pigeon. I don't know.
We got to get this letter to Chisholm by October. Don't worry, the Pony Express has internet. Latency comes into play next. Internet, San Francisco to New York City, about a 40 millisecond ping, which is, I think, optimistic. This is equivalent to about 1.2 years.
That's quite a while.
Some people's whole life. The internet from San Francisco to Australia, 183 milliseconds, is 6 years.
Yep.
Rebooting your virtualized OS, like if you have an OS running in a VM hypervisor on your machine, about 4 seconds on the PC, 127 years compared to the 1 cycle 1 second clock time.
That's longer than a lifetime.
Rebooting the virtualization hypervisor, I assume that's what they're talking about here, is 40 seconds. That's 1200 years.
Mm-hmm.
And mashing the reset button on your computer and letting it come back up, which takes about 90 seconds. 3 millennia.
So the processor has seen some shit.
Yeah, this is some dark magic. I think that this was posted. I should have grabbed the link, but this was in an article that they had linked to elsewhere. And I found it incredibly informative.
A little bit unsettling to me.
Like, it's a little scary when you think about how much this is from a site called formulasblack.com. And if you Google compute performance distance of data as measure of latency, it'll pop up for you. And we'll put a link in the show notes too. But this is like, we spent a long time talking about like how to visualize this kind of time scale at Maximum PC. And this is easily the best and should have been the most obvious solution for that. I don't think I would have trusted our math, frankly, because I would have gotten to the, it takes 1.2 years to send a packet from New York to San Francisco and been like, we probably didn't carry a zero right here somewhere. We should go back and plug this back into the spreadsheets.
Yeah, but aside with formulas in the name, I think you can probably rest assured that their data is good. This is unsettling to me from the standpoint of putting into relief how much of our lives we are spending in front of computers.
Yeah.
And also just thinking about a CPU's experience of time longer than you think will.
It's funny.
Longer than you think.
There's in Neal Stephenson's Seven Eves, which is one of my favorite books, they talk about, like, there's a space-based society, and they talk about processors and memory and things like that that you can't build in outer space because of cosmic radiation messing. There's a reason we still use like 80s CPUs on a lot of space probes, and it's because they're higher process, very large processes by today's standards, so that a stray particle smashing into the CPU as it's flying through space doesn't jack up the mash and crash the whole thing. Right.
Literally need a bigger surface area on the chip to try to be more resilient.
Wider pathways for the electrons are safer is my understanding. I'm sure that somebody in the Discord will correct me when I'm wrong on that, but
that's wild.
Yeah, it's a trip.
We do have people working in space technology there.
Exactly.
Well, last question. All right. This is going to be the longest cold open in history of this podcast.
Oh, we're not even close to that.
I take it you haven't read The Jaunt. I don't think you got my reference a minute ago.
No.
Oh man.
What's okay. The Jaunt?
I shouldn't tell you because I think you should read it. It's a Stephen King short story about teleportation.
Ooh.
That you should really read if you want to look at these numbers and feel a sense of creeping dread.
Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad. Hey, hello. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Hello. Hello. Hi.
What's happening?
We're doing a podcast, Brad.
Oh, crap. Shit, I gotta go get my...
Yeah, when Mr. Softy, the ice cream truck, came to town, I put on a pair of dungarees last Thursday. So
fair. You don't want to show your knees to the ice cream guy.
No.
You need some level of decorum when you go buy ice cream.
It is like if you are going to order a ridiculous ice cream cone for an adult, like something rolled in sprinkles or dusted with Oreos ground up or something like that, you need to have a certain modicum of decency, I think.
Gotta put on your business pants.
Exactly. So we've got an interesting topic today.
Yes.
We were talking the other day about early video cards, and I guess I hadn't forgotten, but I hadn't considered that there was once a time in the early days of 3D accelerators when there were at least 7 or 8 different vendors actively selling cards in that space.
Yeah, and I'm sad we didn't save this exercise for this episode. We played it out on Discord last night.
Yeah.
I tried to run down, like, kind of walk down memory lane and remember what all those companies were, and now I kind of know what they are, but we should try to recreate it here just for the sake of the audience.
Yeah.
Also, just a little bit of context for this episode. I don't know about you, but I think for me, like, I've just had this topic on the brain a lot because this is the first time in, I don't know, 4 or 5 years at least that I felt like genuinely excited about new PC hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Between the 3080s and the new AMD, the new Ryzens and stuff, like PC hardware for the longest time for me has just been like, I guess I'll get a new CPU. Sure. Why not? Like, it's cheap enough right now. You know, there's just not been a lot to be excited about there. Like the 1080, I feel like was a big leap forward. Like, you know, maybe the RTX cards were interesting, but not as fast as you wanted the 20 series. But like we're at a sweet spot right now where I'm like, I'm actually staring at hardware builds a lot right now again and like fantasizing. So that takes me back to the mid 90s and those heady days of 8,000 3D accelerators coming out all the time.
Well, you'll see an actual real world performance improvement for like spending money on new hardware, right? In a way that you often don't, which is exciting. Yes. Let's start with, like, obviously everybody remembers 3DFX.
Yeah.
And then NVIDIA had the Riva 128 early on. ATI rolled out the 3D Rage.
I'm just going to play act what I did last night. Okay. So what I was able to come up with off the top of the head.
Yeah.
Was the first one that came to mind was the Rendition Verite. I don't know why.
The original DirectX card. Yeah.
The rendition verite, obviously the 3D effect, like the voodoo stuff was like the thing as soon as it came out, like nothing else mattered for a while there.
Well, actually, that's not true. It wasn't until Quake came out that the voodoo stuff really mattered.
Well, yeah, GeoQuake was the thing that that made 3D accelerators a thing, frankly.
Because I think you got MechWarrior or something with your voodoo card, MechWarrior 2, and it was like a lightly texture mapped version of the software rendered MechWarrior game.
Not that 3D accelerated. Also, I think I bought that game at a Sam's Club, so I really lost out there.
I bought it multiple times, I'm sure. It came with every video card you bought for a while there.
You know what? I would have bought it just for that soundtrack multiple times. So that's totally fair.
Fine game.
So for whatever reason, I came up with rendition and 3D effects, and then I stalled out and started thinking about like Number 9 and Matrox, which I don't think fit into this conversation that well.
Well, so Number 9 never really released a 3D accelerator. They were wholly focused on 2D and video, is my understanding, and they kind of disappeared. I think they got bought by somebody. I don't actually know what happened to Number 9. I also don't think that their bit of selling graphics cards with with Beatles tie-ins would probably fly in today's world.
I agree with you. It was a bit too twee for my taste, but
I feel like the people at Apple Records would probably have something to say about that now. Maybe in a way that they would not have been aware of back then.
Sure. You're probably right. Like I'm sitting here looking at their Wikipedia page and some of their products for people that are not familiar with Number 9. Revolution.
Yeah.
Imagine. Pepper.
I feel like Revolution.
Ticket to Ride.
Yeah, Ticket to Ride was where they went off the rails in terms of like
naming a graphics card Ticket to Ride is like, yes, absolutely. That is a bridge too far.
I mean, that said, though, there's a board game called Ticket to Ride, right?
Well, that's fine. I mean, that's probably got trains in it or something. It does I'm fine with that. But that's not a video card, you know? So, we'll probably touch on it some more. But I, for whatever reason, my mind went to Matrox and Number 9, which are more like 2D graphics cards, which is like, for people who were not doing PC stuff in the 90s, yes, you used to just have to buy a 2D graphics card.
Yeah. One in the VL bus slot.
Right. So you reminded me that ATI was active back then. For whatever reason in my mind, ATI was not a player until the Radeon stuff, but obviously they were in it way before that.
So they made 2D cards. Like that's where they started 2D cards and video processing stuff. And they were like in the 2D graphics card realm, there was like S3 kind of at the low end, performant, but not very good. Maybe not like didn't the image quality. Like, here's the fun thing. 2D graphics cards, image quality mattered. Like some of them were better at it than others.
That's why I mean, we're kind of getting back onto 2D cards and off the topic of 3D accelerators here. But like I lusted after a Matrox Millennium for so long.
And it,
I think whatever like. Whatever crappy no-name pre-built computer we had at home had a similarly crappy no-name 2D card in it.
Yeah.
And the desktop literally did not look great. Like, I don't know how to qualify that because in my mind, like, I can't call to mind what the desktop looked like, but I think things were like maybe a little too fuzzy or like it was something about like the VGA output was not clean enough or something like that. Well, I forget.
So part of it was that the RAM DAC, the thing that converted the digital signal into an analog signal that went out across VGA, if they were slow or bad, you'd get fuzzy signals on the VGA.
But
also it was about color reproduction and like window rendering speed and stuff like that. Yes. Like in Windows 3.1, with the right video card, you could preview the window while you drag it around.
And
if you didn't have the right video card, it would just be like an outline, a box outline of an empty window.
Yeah, the little dotted line outline.
And then you could watch it literally draw back in from the top to the bottom.
Okay,
if you had a slow video card.
Our card was not that bad, thankfully. But I remember wanting a Millennium just because, it accelerated Windows stuff more and it had very nice, like clean signal.
32-bit, baby.
Yeah.
So the thing that happened around the time 3D accelerators started taking off was that what had previously been low and mid-range 2D parts became pretty good, like good enough, right? So S3, ATI, Revolution was always on the high end, Number 9 was always on the high end, stuff like that. But so Matrox and ATI, both fine Canadian companies.
Yes.
The Rage 2 was kind of, I think it was billed as a 3D accelerator and you could get it with a copy of MechWarrior 2, but it was like kind of lightly texture mapped but they're not really was the thing I recall on that one.
Was that their first major card, the Rage 2 in the 3D space? And was that an all in one card or was that an add on?
So it was an all of these were all in one cards except for the 3D FX stuff. There were
interesting.
And Power VR was 3D only too.
Yeah. So we haven't before we move on, just to finish our little rundown of the roster here. S3, I guess, was huge, but I had completely in my mind like glossed over the fact that they even existed.
S3 was a big deal. Like S3,
it took me a minute, but the name S3 Verge finally floated back into my consciousness.
VIRGE.
Right. I couldn't remember if it was ER or IR.
So that's how much
I'd forgotten it, but
buttloads of 2D cards into like Compaq and Packard Bell and like all the they sold a lot to OEMs. The big OEMs.
Okay.
And they also would kind of run. So one of the defining gate for me on 3D accelerators in like 1996, 97, 98 was, would it run Quake?
Yes.
Like in the days before DirectX, before Direct3D and like the second wave of 3D accelerated games that started in like 97. Like it was, if it didn't run GLQuake, it didn't count as a 3D accelerator, even if it totally did like a little bit of MIP mapping and stuff like that on some textures. And the Rage 2 wouldn't run Quake. The Matrox Millennium wouldn't run Quake. The S3 cards wouldn't run Quake.
Just a 2D card, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it wasn't until the Mystique that Matrox had a card that would run Quake, kind of.
They tried.
So the ATI's first Quake card was the Rage Pro, which was also one of the first AGP cards, which we'll get to in a minute.
Yeah.
Okay. So S3, I don't think S3 ever in the time period that mattered made a compelling 3D card.
Would you categorize them as an also ran in this space?
Well, so one of the things that's interesting about hold on. We have a couple more. Intel was making 3D accelerators.
So Intel, when you threw that out there, I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Remember that in the slightest.
So they made, they partnered with Lockheed and a company called Chips and Technologies that Intel ended up buying a little bit later, and released the i740, which was another early AGP card. And it was, if you recall, RAM was really expensive and hard to get then during that time period.
Vaguely.
So like there'd been some sort of disaster, an earthquake or a fire or something that cratered RAM production 93 or 94, and it took a long time to come back online because it was a different time back then. So a lot of the AGP design was set up so that you could run video stuff out of system memory rather than having to have, you know, eight megabytes of RAM in the system and another 4 megabytes of RAM on the video card,
which was an astronomical amount of RAM.
It's shocking. It was shocking. At that point, hundreds of dollars.
I might have had 16 megabytes in my PC at that point.
Oh, really? I think I probably had 8 and was pretty happy. Anyway.
Maybe it was 8. I forget. But I mean, that's back when RAM was like $50 a megabyte.
More than that. At one point, I paid $150 per megabyte for a 2 megabyte upgrade.
Wow. That is physically painful to hear. Yeah,
that was in 93, though.
Okay. Yeah. So I just glanced at the Intel, the i740 page, the Wikipedia page, and that came out in 98. So we're kind of swinging back and forth across a like 2-3 year time span back and front here a little bit.
So yeah, it's a weird time because like during the launch of the first version of like the Revo 128 launched at a time when like probably the only 3D accelerated things were Quake and Unreal and maybe like Terminal Reality. There were probably some 3D Realms game like Terminal Reality or something that was 3D accelerated at that point.
Sure. That sounds right.
But it was like, mostly
very limited.
Yeah, it was, and there were some flight sims. I feel like Falcon 6.0 3D accelerated for the first time, maybe.
Oh, was it that far along? Or I thought they were on like 3.0.
Maybe it was 3.0. Then. Yeah, it was the one with the big binder.
Yeah, 3.0 came out in 91. Did they ever even get past 4.0? I thought that was the last Falcon.
Maybe I'm conflating 4.0, two different things.
4.0 was 98, so that was probably 3D accelerated at that point. So, well, just to kind of start back at the start before we get too much into the AGP and the late 90s stuff. Like, obviously, like 3D effects, like a friend of mine got a Voodoo card, you know, not long after GLQuake came out. And like, I went over to his house and saw it and fell out of my chair, you know, like the defining moment in my history with both technology and video games. But Like, you could, did you have much contact with that stuff before the voodoo came along? Like, I'm trying to get a sense of what there, what was in the market before the voodoo, but when that kind of, you know, that, obviously that revolutionized everything, but like.
Well, so like I bought a Rage 2 card when I built a PC the first time.
Okay.
And put that in. It may have been even before that. It may have been in my, the Pentium 60 that I bought when I went to UT. And like, I was kind of unimpressed with it. Like 3D accelerators until the Voodoo card seemed like kind of like, it seemed like a cool thing for SGI to do. And it seemed like something that wasn't real for people at home. So like, sure. Like if you played like the rendition VQuake port that they made. So the other thing that's important to note is that up until Quake, most games only supported external, like proprietary vendor specific APIs. So right. Glide for 3DFX. Like Glide is
the famous example.
Exactly.
Right?
Rendition wrote VQuake, which was for their Verite V1000.
Oh, VQuake.
And I think Carmack helped with that, obviously.
So I'm not to derail, but I'm sitting here. There is a GitHub repo that has every plan file update he ever wrote. So I'm just sitting here control effing it. And it's funny, like, so Quake came out in mid-96, and I'm sitting here looking at an entry for December 13th, 96, where he says, for the record, here is my impression of the 3D hardware I have worked with, blah, blah, blah.
This was a defining moment for me, this plan file.
So basically the two consumer cards on this list are the Rendition Verite at $150 and the 3DFX Voodoo at $300.
Yep.
And then like 8 or 10 workstation cards that no mortal could ever have contact with.
3D Labs one, the SGI Eric stuff.
The Intergraph Intense 3D, the SGI O2, the SGI Impact, the, let's see.
Just to be clear, the SGI O2 was like a $50,000 computer, as I recall.
Yes, that literally this SGI Impact entry, he said here, a full system was literally $25,000 to $50,000.
Yeah.
And SGI Infinite Reality was over $100,000.
Yeah, and those machines, those boxes for those things were huge. Like they were like mini computer type spaces, not PCs.
His quick write up of the SGI Infinite Reality, which is the $100,000 workstation. Fill rate from hell, polygons from hell. If you don't trip up on state changes, nothing will come within shouting distance of the system. You would expect that.
Yeah.
For the reason I bring this up is that like I said, outside of the Verite and the Voodoo, like everything else on here is extremely high end workstation hardware. There just wasn't that much out there. There was one other card on here, the 3D Labs Per Media for $300.
That was a workstation card.
Yeah, that's okay. Yes, a well supported low end OpenGL card. So I guess that would be for workstation stuff.
So it was a thing, if I recall correctly. It was the least expensive way to get a fully fledged OpenGL stack because the OpenGL driver for the 3DFX cards was just a wrapper. So it wrapped the OpenGL calls to Glide calls.
Okay.
And it wasn't a full implementation. And because that card was a standalone 3D accelerator and couldn't do stuff in Windows, a lot of OpenGL stuff, like you couldn't run your OpenGL CAD programs on that.
Right.
Also, probably didn't have memory.
And so that's why you were having to get a bespoke version of Quake for every card, right?
Exactly.
Quake, GL Quake, because they were all being written directly to what those cards could do.
Well, so GL Quake was written for OpenGL.
Yes, it would run on any GL hardware. Yeah,
VQuake. So Carmack did VQuake with the Rendition people, I think. And then after that, he was like, I'm not building a bunch of proprietary Quakes. There's no other. We're going to do this in OpenGL. And like that immediately made OpenGL a gaming API when it had previously been for the workstations and CAD and stuff like that.
Previously had been for doing your effects in Terminator 2 and Jurassic Park.
Pretty much, yeah.
And stuff like that.
It was a weird time. Like,
it was a really weird, interesting time with all this stuff being very emergent and not well-defined. Like, we won't harp on his plan files for this whole episode, but if you scroll down two more entries past the one I was just reading from, you get to what I consider probably the seminal plan update.
Okay.
Which is December 23rd, 1996, entitled OpenGL versus Direct3D.
Oh, and this was when they were talking about, this was before Direct3D was even out, right?
Right.
What, 96 you said?
Yeah, this was December 96. So that's like 6-ish months after Quake came out.
Oh, so that's when Direct3D 3.0, DirectX 3.0 had launched in September of that year. And we were, like, DirectX 1 and 2 were kind of not worth speaking of.
Right. And like, this is full on like soapbox mode. He's just here kind of opining about how these things work and mm-hmm. how much he likes or hates them. And there's like straight up code snippets in this thing of like showing how Vertex operations work in each one and stuff like this. But, it was just such an early time and the stuff was so ill-defined and like all over the place, you know?
Well, I mean, the big argument was that the DirectX APIs kind of limited what you could do. Like, well, it didn't give you direct control over the hardware in a way that was, it abstracted things out a little bit further than people like Carmack wanted. I think with the idea that it would be easier for normal human programmers that weren't John Carmack or Tim Sweeney or, you know, Charlie Brown or whoever to build off of.
Right. But also it became necessary in a world with like 800 different cards on the market, right? Like yeah. At some point you can't be writing directly to the hardware of every model of card out there.
Well, so then it shifted the burden from the developers to write for the individual hardware to the driver vendors to like not jack up the drivers.
Ah, yes. Which led to our current state of 500 megabyte graphics driver downloads every 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
That makes sense. But was there a lot of like FUD around Microsoft? Oh. I feel like I vaguely remember like
Jesus. People
just, I mean, this was FUD. This was squarely in the middle of the like people writing Microsoft with a dollar sign in it era of people not trusting Microsoft.
This is when the antitrust suit was in the barest beginnings, right?
I guess so. Yeah.
This is when they were doing the stuff that got them sued by the federal government for
that's fair.
Yeah. It was
embrace, extend, extinguish.
Like, yeah, I feel like a lot of the concern about Microsoft owning the APIs that drove 3D was the same thing that we hear people talking about with Facebook and VR right now, where, you know, you didn't want this monolithic company to own the thing that the future, you know, the APIs that the future was built on. It ended up like the thing that ended up happening is, As the hardware vendors coalesced into from 8 or 9 vendors into 2 vendors, or maybe 3 if you count Intel, it ended up being the hardware vendors driving those APIs as much as Microsoft. So it ended up working out. If we had only ended up with one, if we only ended up with either Intel or AMD, ATI and Intel, I think we'd be in a much different situation and we wouldn't be seeing the kind of performance that we are on graphics today. So it was lucky that at least 2 companies survived.
Because they pushed it forward so much, you mean?
They push each other, yeah.
Yeah.
The competition's good, it turns out.
Yeah. Before we move on too much from the beginnings here, I happen to have the Rendition Wikipedia page in front of me and I just have to mention the naming on some of this stuff.
Yeah.
They had an API for DOS called Speedy3D.
That sounds great. How fast was it?
I don't know. I just can't help thinking about like Speedy Gonzalez here. scrolling down some of the products that were released. Sierra. Wait, who? That can't be. That's not the game maker Sierra. That's got to be. Really?
I think that's somebody else. I think that's what became Sierra's Logic, maybe.
It totally links to the Sierra Online Wikipedia page. Apparently, Sierra put out a rendition card called the Screamin' 3D.
We had one of those in the lab at Maximum PC.
Really?
It was the box was on the wall.
I totally am sitting here Googling the box art for Screamin' 3D right now. I need to see that.
Oh, the box art for these was all bad.
If you think video card boxes are ridiculous now, go back to the mid-90s.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, like I don't know where to go with this. I mean, Rendition was out there like in my mind like some months before the Voodoo came along. VQuake was a thing.
That's correct. Yeah.
And then the Voodoo came along and like changed everything, of course. But to touch on something you mentioned earlier, I did not realize that the Voodoo was the exception to the rule about being an all-in-one integrated card. Like, because the Voodoo was an add-in card and you had to run a literal analog pass-through cable.
You plugged your video. You had a little short VGA cable that plugged from your main video card into the Voodoo card. Yeah, and then you plugged
desktop card.
Yeah. And then you plugged the monitor into the Voodoo card and it would literally do a state switch. Like the Voodoo card would detect that you'd launch something that used Glide and it would turn off the pass through and just render itself.
You would at least with the card I had, which I believe was the Orchid Righteous 3D.
That was one of the two. Was that or the Diamond Monster 3D?
It was not the Diamond Monster, which was the gold standard to most people. But
I think they were both exactly the same cards. Just
all,
to be clear,
they were all practically the same. Except now seems like the time to touch on my teenage lust for the Canopus Pure 3D.
Now that was a card.
which was just a Voodoo card, except it had 2 extra megabytes of memory. I think it had 6 megabytes of memory on it.
Well, so Canopus did some other weird stuff, too, because they had an integrated card that was like a 2D card with a daughter card on it that was the 3D FX card. So it was all in one thing. And it also Canopus did internal pass-throughs if you had a Canopus 2D card and a Canopus 3D card.
Maybe that's what I was interested in. That was a Japanese company.
So yeah, they made arcade boards was the other thing that they did. Because they did those Obsidian I want to say what was that jet ski race game, the arcade game?
Jet ski.
Anyway,
let's pretend we remembered.
Yeah, they made people are screaming at their radios right now, but they made a bunch of they made the 3D, like for a lot of those early arcade cabinets that were driven by 3DFX hardware, they made those boards and put enough RAM on them that they could run at like arcade resolutions.
Sure.
And they would also jam multiple texturing units on, which is like that's the interesting thing. So first off, all of these cards are passively cooled. At most, they had a heat sink, which was sometimes viewed as a negative in the press at the time.
Right. I'm sitting here looking at the Canopus Wikipedia page, which is very short. It's like 3 paragraphs, but it says when the Voodoo 2 was released, the Canopus Pure 3D2 was praised for the fact that their cards were shorter than the competitors' Voodoo 2 cards.
Yeah. It fit in more cases. Yeah. Well, so I had an AST Pentium 60 at that point, I think. And that card was a pizza box case. And there were a small number, like if you had a giant long chonker of a video card, it just wouldn't go in there.
Right. But yeah, God, was the mentality basically that if you need a heatsink on your card, you have screwed up on the design end?
Pretty much. Yeah. Like my Pentium 60 didn't have a heatsink. It was just chip.
My Pentium 75 did not either. And that machine became quite unstable over time.
Shocking that. Who knew?
Granted, to be fair, I had overclocked it to 75. So that probably... No, I'm sorry. It was a 75 to 90.
Yeah, that was what the job.
I had a 75 and it was not stable at 100, but I could overclock it to 90. And then it became borderline unusable after about a year and a half.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Weird. Weird that.
I was going to mention with the pass through on the Voodoo cards, like you would hear, I don't know if it was just the one I had or maybe they all did this, but you would hear that good solid, like metallic thunk sound every time it switched over to the 3D card.
I think that was in the monitor though, wasn't it? Because it was a refresh change, probably.
Maybe it was the monitor.
It was like a ka-chunk.
Yeah,
it wasn't. There wasn't like a physical switch in the cards, though.
No.
Yeah, there was no solenoid popping or anything like that.
You think it was more of a ka-chunk than a thunk?
So they did. 3DFX did there's a lot. Like, it was a weird time because also, like, so what a 3D. These things weren't called GPUs because there wasn't a lot of processing. Basically, they were just like texture mapping engines on a card.
Yeah. I think 3D accelerator was the accepted term back then, right?
That's what we called them, yeah. And they would basically what the CPU would do all the triangle setup and all that stuff, and it would establish a mesh, and then the video cards would handle Z buffering, so they'd see what was visible in that scene, and then they'd apply textures to it. And like there were a wide variety of approaches to that. PowerVR did this tile based thing where they didn't do visibility checks on the whole scene at once. They would just do the little chunks, and then that would save them a buttload of memory bandwidth, basically, because they were only pulling textures for things that they would actually map. As I recall, that was also one of the ones that had problems in their OpenGL stack, where there were giant cracks in the world where the tiles didn't line up right or something. I don't know exactly what was happening there, but I remember in that instance, it was bad. The other thing that was weird about PowerVR was it was a standalone 3D accelerator, but it you could do 3D in a window on that because it passed over to the 2D cards frame buffer.
Oh, interesting.
Across PCI.
Right. I don't know if we mentioned it. That was another limitation of the Voodoo, was that it could not do windowed 3D, only full screen.
No windowed 3D on the Voodoo 1 or Voodoo 2, only on the Rush and the Banshee and the 3 eventually.
Right. Those were their integrated cards. The other downside that I didn't mention of, and then maybe this was also model specific, but it made my 2D desktop look like shit.
It made everything fuzzy.
Which made me want to die because that was right after I got a Matrox Millennium. I finally got the good 2D desktop card that made everything nice and sharp and smooth.
And then I
got a Voodoo and it made it look like shit again.
Well, so the other thing about all these cards is that they were really low resolution. Like at a time when a normal desktop was probably 800 by 600.
Yeah.
I don't think you could run a Voodoo 1 card above 640 by 480.
No, definitely not at any performance. Maybe not at all, but definitely didn't have not
memory.
At any
yeah.
level of performance. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And the thing that was amazing about those early cards is you went from like these kind of not grainy exactly, but it was real grungy software rendering in Quake. While a technical marvel was kind of scuzzy feeling.
Yeah.
And then when you loaded up something that could do MIP mapping on the textures, which is basically where it looks at has different resolutions of the texture and the video card knows to drop the right one in at the right distances, you got these unbelievably clear textures. You're like, wait, is this what this game is supposed to look like? And I played it all the way through not looking like this. This is kind of magic. And then, you know, games like, And still, like, if you're looking at a texture that would have had multiple mipmap levels across, like if you're looking down the length of a wall, right, you would get one of the mipmap levels in the wall because we didn't have an isotropic filtering or trilinear filtering or anything like that on the cards at that point. So it wasn't able to sample different MIP levels based on where the like for the different distances of that same texture that you were looking at. But it was still kind of incredible. And then when the Voodoo 2 came out, all of a sudden you had multi-texturing that could happen in one pass. So like each frame could have multiple two textures applied to each surface. So you'd have like a lighting texture and a picture texture, right?
Okay. Trying to think of some other like real world use cases for that. I mean, is that when you were able to start applying like decals to walls, like bullet holes and blood and stuff like that? Or
that was probably later, because I feel like the Voodoo 2 actually had like there were three chips on the texture on the chip. There was one that was the FX chip, and then there were two TX chips that each was responsible for one texture pass per cycle per frame. So you could do that before, but it would take multiple passes on each frame to do a multi-texturing pass is my understanding, but I could be wrong. I don't know. This was from a time before when people talked about this stuff. Like, you know, now NVIDIA and ATI, when they release new GPUs, they sit down with all the tech press and they're like, okay, here's exactly how this stuff works. Here's how deep the pipelines go. Here's how much cache each part has. Here's what the programmable parts of the pipeline are capable of. And back then they just released the cards and there was a like one page spec sheet that they handed out to people at Comdex when they wanted to buy, when they came in and like Compaq rolled in and they're like, well, here's what our new video card can do. It's like, it costs this much. It's, you know, it's going to get this many blit marks and it'll run Quake. And people are like, okay, we're putting that in every Compaq that we're shipping this year.
Good enough.
Yeah.
Ship it.
It was a weird time for yeah. sure.
Was the Voodoo 2 another pass through card that was still not a
Voodoo 2 was a pass through card,
still not another full desktop card. But right?
Also, the Voodoo 2 had an internal SLI port, so you could put two of them in.
Oh god, is that when SLI started?
That's when SLI started, and it would let you play it. I think 1280, 1024 by 768. If you had two of them in SLI, the funny thing is, because of the way that card worked, it is maybe the last time that adding a second video card to your system gave you a 1-to-1 increase in performance for each, like you get double the performance for each, assuming again, because all of the triangle setup and all of that stuff was done on the CPU, assuming your CPUs had fast enough floating point to do that.
So they set very poor expectations for SLI early on that it never lived up to again.
Well, but also, like when I upgraded from a Voodoo 1 to a Voodoo 2, I was on a K6, like 166 or 200 or something that had bad floating point, but good integer math. And it turned out that I saw no performance increase going from the Voodoo 1 to the Voodoo 2 because the CPU couldn't keep up with the card at all.
Well,
everything was CPU bound then.
There's a couple stories here. I mean, there's the thing where 80% of these companies just fell away and either got acquired or went out of business or whatever.
Well, that happens when there's a big shift in the way, like it happened with phones too, right? Like when the iPhone came out and Android rolled out, Nokia and Motorola and all those companies that had been making dumb phones for 10, 15, 20 years, a lot of them didn't survive that transition.
I mean, I guess it's the natural evolution of a new market being created, essentially, right? Because that's what happened with phones and that's what happened here of, you know, there was no market for 3D accelerators and then there was. And so everybody tried to get in and then only a couple of them made it out.
Well, and even the ones that did make it out, like 3DFX got bought by NVIDIA in like in the early 2000s, right?
So that's like there are two stories here. There's the story of when I got a TNT and like everything changed.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. That was that like the Voodoo was like an amazing proof of concept, but the TNT was the first. That's the NVIDIA card for people who don't know. Well, so like those are the kind of twin narratives here are I got my first NVIDIA card, and granted, it sounds like the first couple of NVIDIA cards were not amazing, but the TNT was kind of mind blowing at the time. So there's like kind of the rise of NVIDIA and the all-in-one card that was actually very good. And then there is the like meteoric rise and fall of 3DFX. Like 3DFX went from the name in 3D graphics to not even a going concern in the space of like, what, 4 years?
5 years, I think. Yeah.
Like so, they got acquired by NVIDIA in 2000-ish.
It was right when I started at Maximum PC, as I recall.
And
they sent us a Voodoo 5, 6,000.
Right.
Like a proto board with like wires dangling off of it that was an engineering sample.
Like did the Voodoo 5 even make it to market?
Never made it. Maybe the low end version did, but the four processor one never made it to market.
Right. So like for them to go from the card to get in the Voodoo and Voodoo 2 era to like, I assume they basically sold at fire sale prices to NVIDIA.
I mean, I think they bought IP and engineers and that was it.
Right.
The TNT is an interesting card because like TNT and Rage Pro, like both of those are really important. Rage Pro was in a lot of Gateway machines, as I recall, and Dell machines. So like if you were buying computers for, say a computer lab in 2000, 98, 99, all of a sudden, like a commodity computer could run Quake, right? So yeah. It wasn't like you needed some weird add-in video card that made your 2D desktop look like crap and was going to have all sorts of weird requirements. It just worked.
And that was GL Quake?
That was GL Quake, yeah. The TNT was the higher end version of that. The TNT was a really compelling part when the Riva 128 launched, there was a big interview in Boot in like 96, I guess, or 97. Maybe even 98, where David Kirk, who was the chief scientist at NVIDIA for a long time, was basically doing the apology tour for Riva 128 driver problems and overall shortcomings in that part. And then they rolled out the TNT, which he had hinted at in that interview. And it was the drivers were really solid, which it was a lesson NVIDIA learned early that like without good drivers, it didn't matter how fast the hardware was. It really ripped. Like it was fast. You could run Quake in a window. You could play GL Quake, everything, you know, it was performant and you could play at high resolutions even.
That was my Quake 2 card is my memory of the TNT. I got a TNT maybe sometime after Quake 2 came out and it was also it was an all in one card. So it was nice to just have one card that did desktop and really nice 3D graphics. But also, yeah, it was fast as hell in my memory.
So it's funny, for a long time, I had a TNT card and a Voodoo card in my computer at the same time, just because there was still like Quake 1 still worked better on the Voodoo card than it did on the TNT card because of driver implementation weirdness.
OK, sure.
And I was still playing competitive Quake 1 on the LPB leagues at that point. HPB leagues. Sorry, the hyping people leagues.
You're talking to somebody who got a 3DFX card and started playing Quake on that because my Pentium 75 couldn't run it for shit in software. But then I got a Pentium 200 later.
Yeah.
And I was getting such a high frame rate in software Quake on that thing that I went back to software Quake because I would rather have the frame rate.
You were probably one of those people that would have played NetQuake instead of GL instead of Quake World.
I'm not quite going to go that far.
We talked about those CarMac plan updates, but I remember like you'd see a new plan update from CarMac and you're like, is this going to be about Quake World? Is it going to be about GL Quake? Either one was fine.
Yeah. Like I was reading about the Quake World announcement. Mm-hmm. I was reading that post last night.
Yeah.
When he basically like almost hat in hand came in front of the Quake community and was just like, without in so many words, was just kind of like, look, we get it. The internet performance for NetQuake is unacceptable.
Yeah.
I'm going to fork the code base and start over and deliver a new online client for people. Also, there's an amazing line in there. Gosh, I don't know if I can find it off the top of the head right now.
The first time I played Quake World was at my dad's office because it came out while I was home on Christmas break. And I drove, literally got in the car and drove to the office and downloaded it and put it on his work computer and played software Quake World on his modem there because we didn't have a computer at the house, at mom and dad's house at that point. And I was just like, oh God, I can play this on the modem. This is,
yeah,
it was a whole new
actually playable. Yeah. It felt like a real video game. This is the line from that, from the plan file where he basically reveals the existence of Quake World, where he describes it as a pet research project. If it looks feasible, I would like to see internet focused gaming become a justifiable biz direction for us. It's definitely cool, but it is uncertain if people can actually make money at it.
So I'm sure when he says he's uncertain people can actually make money at it, they were looking at like those pay to play modem dial in services, yeah, like Duango.
Sure.
Where you paid like $5 a month and you could dial into a local thing and play Doom against other people in your, yeah, in your town.
Yes. Obviously there were early attempts at monetizing that kind of stuff, but it just in light of history and where things have gone, seeing somebody say, yeah, I don't know if you can make money at online gaming, but we're going to mess with it.
Maybe, I don't know, man, maybe.
It's kind of amusing.
But yeah, so we were talking about consolidation. Like if we go down this list of the eight companies, so we have 3DFX, PowerVR, NVIDIA, ATI, Matrox, S3, Intel, and Rendition. Rendition's, yeah, gone. I don't I actually don't know what happened to them.
Let me see.
I'm sure they got bought by somebody, but 3DFX got bought by NVIDIA in the early 2000s and for mostly for patents and engineers, is my understanding.
Micron purchased Rendition.
Micron, the memory manufacturer?
That's what this says. Yeah. Wow.
Interesting.
As a source of embedded graphics solutions for their own line of motherboards.
Mm. There you go.
So
PowerVR ended up focusing on mobile, and they are one of the main SoC GPU vendors for ARM processors.
To this day, right?
To like this
that
day.
That name still exists.
Yeah.
With a little detour into the Dreamcast.
That's true. Yeah, they did the V2 version of the Tile VR architecture was the thing that made the Dreamcast work. There was like, look, there was a lot of scene drama around the Dreamcast because everybody thought they were going. Sega had everybody thinking they were going in the Dreamcast. Like 3DFX sued them for $155 million.
What?
Yeah. Because they had given proprietary hardware information because they thought 3DFX was going to power the Dreamcast.
Ooh.
3DFX did a lot of arcade boards for Sega, is my understanding, in that time period.
Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah.
I feel like somebody else also thought they were going in the Dreamcast. And then it turned out going in the Dreamcast wouldn't have helped anyone, really, probably.
not so much. That console lasted, what, about a year and a half?
If that, yeah.
Roughly.
So PowerVR, NVIDIA obviously is NVIDIA and they're powering the future. ATI got bought by AMD in 2006. Mm-hmm. They spun out, they had bought BitBoy's Oi, which was one of those hushed tones on message boards and Usenet companies. Oh my God, companies.
Dude, the game that BitBoy's was talking about their forthcoming product that never materialized was insane.
They came out of the demo scene, like Swedish demo scene.
Yes. They were from Scandinavia, right? Yeah. So they were a bunch of like 64K coders and stuff like that. And I'm trying to remember what claims they were making.
That part doesn't matter.
They were quoting numbers and performance metrics that sounded completely impossible.
They were talking about like next gen. It was the equivalent of them talking about ray tracing in like 2005, right?
Right. And the fact that they never actually shipped a product.
They got bought by ATI right before, yeah, AMD bought ATI. And then when AMD bought ATI for $5 billion or whatever, which was an enormous amount of money then, they spun BitBoy's back out to Qualcomm, who then developed the thing that they were talking about into the Adreno processor, which also is in a lot of, like, that's Qualcomm's GPU SoC component.
Okay. So the BitBoy's people actually shipped a product.
Uh-huh. And hey, look at those letters in Adreno, Brad.
Oh. Yeah.
Is it an anagram?
Maybe. Maybe.
For a popular ATI graphics processor.
Oh, hey, look at that.
Yeah.
Who would have thought?
Yeah. So, I think everybody feels good about that. Artex was another one of those companies that was like in the 30 companies that were developing 3D accelerator technologies in like the late 90s that ended up getting bought by ATI. That's what ended up in the Dolphin, the I guess, which is became the GameCube. Yeah.
Which reminded me that GameCubes straight up have an ATI sticker on them, don't they?
Hell yeah. Yeah. Right on the front.
If I remember, just like the Dreamcast had a Windows CE logo on there somewhere.
Yep. Yep. I mean, let's see. Matrox still makes graphics, video processing stuff and video wall installations and stuff like that.
I was sure that Matrox would have been one of those casualties of this era. But yeah, they're still out there. They make a lot of embedded solutions for like if you've got some giant video wall you need to power.
Well, so Matrox always... They came around in like the early 2000s to Maximum PC. They were the first ones who were like, hey, we think this multi-monitor thing is going to be a big deal.
Huh.
And here's a solution that will let you play your video game across three monitors stretched around. And of course, they were like CRTs with big fat bezels and stuff like that. So it was kind of goofy at the time.
It was too expensive and too bulky to be feasible. The cards couldn't
drive it really because it's too many pixels.
Yeah, but they weren't wrong.
They were not wrong. S3 was bought by, I can't remember who bought them. I want to say Intel, but I don't think that's right.
I looked it up last night and I'm totally forgetting here. Let me just,
Intel, obviously.
Oh, they're owned by HTC.
HTC. That's right.
And in fact, the S3 name, I believe, is still in use.
On mobile parts, probably?
I might be wrong about that, actually.
Well, so Intel, after the i740 and the i752, which was the follow-up, they did multiple other, like, they went through the whole Larrabee thing where they were going to revolutionize the graphics pipeline with a bunch of lo-fi x86 cores.
Right.
And then it just basically disappeared. And Rendition, you said, ended up at...
I've already forgotten. It's so hard to keep all this. Micron.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
So yeah, it was a weird, and like during this time, there were so many, everybody looked at what the hardware was capable of and where the market was going. And they decided different approaches to how to feed those markets. So like, you know, Rendition and Intel were looking at the price of memory and were like, well, nobody's going to put lots and lots of memory on these cards ever. So, you know, here we should just roll out these high speed interfaces to system memory and let everybody do everything out of system memory. And NVIDIA and ATI looked at what the CPUs were capable of in terms of triangle setup. We're like, we're going to hit a wall on this really fast. So we need to get like some computation on these processors. So it's not just doing bitmapping and trilinear filtering.
And thus the dawn of hardware transform and lighting.
And yeah, that's when the GPU, when NVIDIA launched the GeForce 256 and ATI launched the Radeon 6 months later, it was a transformative moment.
I mean,
the computationally expensive part of playing games on these 3D accelerators suddenly moved off of the CPU and onto the GPU.
Right. Like that conceptually is the beginning of the modern era of the GPU, right?
I think so. Basically. Yeah.
I didn't realize the Radeon was that close to the GeForce in getting to market.
So I started at Maximum PC. This is easy for me to remember. I started at Maximum PC in June of 2000. And my first meeting with a vendor as a Maximum PC employee was a Radeon meeting the second day I was there. And so they probably didn't roll it out for another 3 months at that point because everybody brought us stuff super early so we could have timely coverage. But that was a big deal.
Huh. In my mind, I mean, this is probably because I always bought NVIDIA products, so that's just what I remember. But like in my mind, I don't remember the Radeon name being out there until Half-Life 2, but that's obviously a marketing. That's a legacy.
That was way later. Yeah.
They're marketing, right? They obviously were around way before that. So
one of the things that NVIDIA did that turned out to be really smart because of the thing that you just said is that they rolled out DDR memory was late coming.
Yeah.
So they just rolled out an SDR version of the GeForce like 6 months before the DDR cards.
I was still on a TNT one.
Yeah.
So I bought an SDR GeForce because I was desperate to have it.
Yeah.
Because that was the era of Quake 3, and I really needed Quake 3 to run better.
It turns out the DDR cards, since everything was fill rate limited, were almost twice as fast as the SDR cards.
Yeah, that was perhaps a hasty decision. I was always off cycle for whatever reason. I got a Voodoo 1,
Okay.
But then I tried to stretch my hardware as long as I could just for money reasons.
Yeah, of course.
So I skipped the Voodoo 2.
Oof, that was a mistake.
And I got a TNT 1.
Yeah.
And then the TNT 2 came along. It was dramatically better.
Yeah.
Then I got a GeForce 256 SDR because I was due for a card. And then the DDR version came out and was massively better. And then the GeForce 2 was even better than that. I think I stayed on that. I'm trying to remember. I want to say I stayed on that GeForce 256 until the GeForce 4.
Probably 3 or 4 would have been the next upgrade. Yeah.
I skipped the GeForce 3 because that was when I started at GameSpot, so I was playing a ton of games on consoles. That was my coverage beat. So I didn't get I got the low end GeForce 4 was my next card after that.
Well, and I was going to say that's when the GeForce 4, I think, is when they started differentiating. Like, they started having multiple SKUs that weren't just clocked down versions of the same chip. They were like versions of the chip that didn't bin or that parts were burned out on or something. And they had the GeForce MX, I think, was the low end version of those cards. And then the TIs were the high ends, and then the regular ones were just the GeForces.
I believe I had a TI 4200.
That was a fine card. Oh, right. They did numbers on those. I forgot.
Yes.
So
which was the low end of it was the TI 4200, 4400 and 4600. So
that was a weird time because the pipelines were still fixed function. So it wasn't like a general purpose compute pipeline. Like, if they wanted to add new features, then they had to put silicon on for it, or you had to do it on the CPU. And it wasn't until the 5 series with the leaf blower, the 5800, that changed, which was a few years later. So
yeah.
And that's when the general purpose compute pipeline happened on the GPU, really. That's when that started. Like, they weren't feature complete for a few more years after that because they didn't have full if and or XOR, you know, all the different gates that you need.
Yeah.
But it was pretty cool.
So that pretty much takes us into the modern era, both in terms of like the internal design of what a GPU is and also in the market dominance of the companies that made it through. But the last thing I wanted to touch on real quick, or just expand on, was if you have a good sense of why 3DFX cratered so hard and so fast.
Yeah, they never made a compelling 2D, 3D part.
Is that all it was?
I mean, it was first mover disadvantage, right? So they established the market and they set it up, and then they didn't ever have their products were always niche products in a market that needed to be mainstream, and NVIDIA and ATI had mainstream parts immediately.
They couldn't go in commodity PCs because they were an extra part, not a replacement part, right? Like, they couldn't replace the desktop card. They had to be there in addition to a desktop
card. So instead of adding like $4 to the cost of the thing for Compaq or Packard Bell or eMachines or whoever, it was another $150 to the OEM, and they weren't, like, unless they could sell it into gamers, It wasn't like if you look at it from a if you're the purchaser for Compaq, who's selling 2 million PCs a year or something, and you're looking at ATI with the Rage Pro and NVIDIA with the TNT 2 and 3DFX with a TNT 2 plus a Voodoo 2 or Voodoo Banshee, whatever, Voodoo 3, their Voodoo 3 performance was never very good. Right. Like, those cards couldn't compete with the TNT 2 and the Rage Pro.
Voodoo 3 was an all-in-one, to be clear.
Everything after the Voodoo 2 was an all-in-one.
Okay.
So
the Banshee was just straight up bad, right?
Banshee was straight up bad. The Voodoo Rush was really bad. The Banshee was an okay 2D card that had kind of passable 3D on it. The Voodoo 3 was fine. Like, it was not a bad card necessarily. It just wasn't, like, it wasn't as competitive with NVIDIA. And I feel like they also leaned on Glide longer than they should have, where NVIDIA was building robust Direct3D and OpenGL drivers that were native. Voodoo was using the Glide wrapper for OpenGL for a long time.
I think, now that you mention it, I think that was another revelation of getting that TNT, was that it just played a lot more games.
Like I said, the Riva 128 was a real wake-up call, I feel like, at NVIDIA, where they were like, oh, right, it doesn't matter how good our hardware is if the drivers suck.
API support is lacking.
Yeah. Yeah, they've spent a lot of time. I mean, if you look at the size of their DevRel org in NVIDIA versus other comparable companies then and even probably now, it's pretty astounding how aggressively they spend money on that. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense.
That reputation persists to this day. Like, you see it on message boards all the time. And in fact, like, that's in the back of my mind, like, NVIDIA is the one with the good drivers. Like, that's a big part of the reason that I always bought their cards.
Yeah. I thought we were going to talk about Direct3D and OpenGL we kind of skipped past this, but at the same time, undercurrent behind all of this was like, what's going to be the future of 3D rendering? Is it going to be this weird open consortium, or is it going to be Direct3D? And it turns out that the open consortium never was able to move fast enough to support the new hardware. So vendors were always writing OpenGL extensions to support the new, like the hardware transform and lighting and the bump mapping and the normal maps and all that stuff. Just never landed on the OpenGL side. It made supporting OpenGL really difficult.
Right. And like that dynamic persists to this day, right? Like DX12 was robust and mature and on the market for ages before Vulkan really became a thing, right? I don't know if those are as directly comparable.
The Vulkan is complicated for whole other reasons, but
I came upon a Twitter thread of graphics programmers the other day kind of grousing about Vulkan in a way that I hadn't seen before. That made me think maybe my understanding of Vulkan is not as complete as it could be.
Was it the one about here's the number of lines of code it takes to draw a triangle in Vulkan?
Something like that.
Yeah. The other weird thing about Direct3D, like, they iterated Direct3D so fast at that time period. Like, they never released Direct3D. There was no Direct3D 1. Direct3D 2.0 launched in June of 1996. Direct3D 3.0 launched in September of that same year.
Wow.
So, like, 4 months, 5 months, right? And, like, I think the only Direct3D 2 game I ever remember playing was Tom Clancy's SSN, that submarine, like, the underwater piloting game where you flew the submarine like a plane. And they didn't really, like, Microsoft was iterating that so quickly that they were releasing Direct3D 3.0A, 3.0B, 3.0C month to month to month. So you're always downloading these new things. But as a result, by the time they got to 5 or 6, because they skipped 4, it was robust and like worked.
I feel like I remember DirectX 5 lasting for a very long time.
Five was for a while. 8 was when they added the programmable pipeline stuff.
Yeah. Those are like 5, 8, 11, and 12 are the big milestones in my memory.
Yeah. So the other big hardware thing, the early hardware feature that made a huge impact on like visual quality that we haven't talked about yet was the Matrox G400, which was the post Mystique. It was like their Rage Pro competitor, I guess, or Rage 128 maybe competitor, around the same time as the TNT. And it had hardware bump mapping support.
Oh. Huh.
Which was really novel, and literally no one used it. So,
because it was the only card that had it.
Yeah.
But I mean, that kind of thing came back around with the GeForce 3, right?
The first one that had bump mapping on the NVIDIA side. I think the G400 might have been later. When I think I might have reviewed that when I was at Maximum PC. I think about it,
I'd have a fun to time.
Go, but yeah, it's been a while.
It was a big mess. It was easy to place the wrong bet back then because there were so many products on the market and everything was so immature.
Cards were really cheap compared to today. Yeah. Like the cards were $200 at the high end.
Yes, that's fair. things have gotten a little pricier now that you mention it.
I mean, $200 was worth more then, but when I went, I remember going to Electronics Boutique to buy a Voodoo 2. I was one of two people in Knoxville, Tennessee who pre-ordered a Voodoo 2 from our Electronics Boutique. And I got a Creative Labs 3DFX Voodoo 2 card that the serial number was like 00000032.
What?
Yeah.
Do you still have it?
No, I got rid of it years ago. I know.
It might be worth something.
I probably have a picture. It wasn't. I looked.
Oh, that was the last thing I wanted to mention before we probably wrap this thing up. But do you remember the weird, I hesitate to use the word cult, but there was like an insanely diehard fan base around 3DFX, like way longer than there should have been.
Oh yeah,
there were people clinging to their voodoos way after it was clear that the industry had moved on.
Look, I had a Voodoo 2 card in my machine well into the Quake 3 era, right?
Okay,
yeah. It was
like if you Google, I should pull this up. Like if you Google images of the Voodoo 5, what an obscene thing that is. Oh, the Voodoo 5 was the one that was going to plug straight into the wall, right?
Voodoo 5 6000. We had, like I said, we got an engineering sample and it had a power brick that was the size of like a gaming laptop power brick that you plugged into a like a dipole port on the back of the card.
Right. And then into the wall, right?
Into the wall. Yeah.
Like directly into the wall. Did not run off the PC's power supply.
No. And it was an incredibly, it was like a workstation length card. It was really, right. really long.
Like if you Google pictures of this thing, it looks Photoshopped. It looks like somebody has copy pasted a video card on top of itself.
It had four of those, like, I don't even know what those fans were called, but it was like a really specific size heatsink fan combo. And it had four of them on it, as I recall.
Yeah, it's gigantic. It's got a handle on it. The other end of the card has a handle on it.
So that was supposed to, so in the olden days, there were slots, like there was the slot that the screw went in. And then the other end of the case for a full length, for a full length card, there was a slot that the other end would go in to support both sides of the card. And that's what that handle was.
That's amazing.
It was to make it reach.
And the reason I bring it up is I have this memory, and this may have been like 100 people. I don't know. And not that big a deal, but there was this weird boutique community of people trying to get their hands on like the Voodoo 5 samples that had gotten out into the wild.
Oh, they were like, highly desirable. Yeah.
And they were trying, there was like a user effort to maintain Glide and bring it forward so they could keep playing games on 3DFX, even after that was no longer a going concern. They really should have just bought an NVIDIA or an ATI card, but they were just like desperately trying to keep 3DFX on life support.
I wonder if somebody ever made like a DirectX or OpenGL to Glide wrapper to go the other way. So you can play Glide games on OpenGL cards or Direct3D cards.
If there's anything I've learned about the internet is that if you have to ask, I wonder if ever someone did X, the answer is yes.
It was a fascinating time because
it was like, fun.
Stuff was happening constantly. Like you would look at plan files for, like I said, like the people who are doing graphics programming at 3D Realms and id and Epic, places like that, Valve. And you would see all sorts of amazing stories come out as a result of that.
Yeah. Things were just iterating way faster back then than they do now.
We have a couple of friends of the pod who we are like ex-3DFX folk that are probably far enough out of NDAs now that we might be able to get them on to talk. So I'll have to ask around.
That would be fun.
But that time, like those guys, they were in Texas and they built this thing. And I don't think at the beginning they didn't realize what they had. And then I think they thought they had more than they did.
Yeah.
Real quickly.
Well, you know, everything's bigger in Texas, right? Yeah,
something like that. but yeah, it was a fun time to be an enthusiast.
For sure.
And I guess that's it for today.
Yeah. A little walk down memory lane.
Yeah. I guess we've reached the point in the show where we talk about the Patreon. If you would like to support Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod, you can by going to patreon.com/techpod. For as little as $2 a month, you will get access to the fabulous Tech Pod Discord, where you find out things like how long time is for a CPU versus human scale. And let's see what else we've talked about. We got a shout out. I idly asked a question in chat the other day, and then one of our fabulous users made an app, a web app that does that
literally coded a solution for us to fulfill a very specific need that we had. I cannot express my gratitude enough. You know who you are.
I think we can out them, right? Frist Hart?
Yeah.
Made beep30.com. If you do a podcast and you need to sync it, we've tried it this week. I'll let you know how it goes next week, I guess.
I don't know if you want to bring that much load to that. I don't know how much capacity he's got to serve that page.
Look, I'm comfortable.
You want to out this thing?
This is a burgeoning business.
Yeah, I guess so.
I want to support all of our fabulous patrons. And yeah, like there's just interesting conversations basically every day in there. It's a fabulous place to hang out. I have enjoyed having human contact during these dark times.
Helps.
And for sure. It's a lovely spot.
Yes.
And as always, we thank all of our patrons for more. If you spend $5 a month, you get access to the monthly patron exclusive episode where we usually talk about projects.
Yeah.
I moved everything over to Home Assistant last week because Smart Things goes away today.
I am following, let's say, 4 to 6 weeks behind in your footsteps.
Uh-huh. How's it going?
I also just, let's say I spent a lot of last weekend messing with Home Assistant on my NAS.
It's really neat.
And then, well, no, not on the NAS. It's not.
Oh, no, the NAS is a pain in the ass. I just bought a Raspberry Pi because it was way easier.
Not in FreeBSD. So, yes, I too just bought a Raspberry Pi 4 to do things like that on, because it's not going to happen in BSD. But we got this Pi 4 here. Well, we should save this. This episode's long already.
Yeah. We'll talk about it.
Debating whether to put Raspbian or Ubuntu on that thing.
I did Raspbian. Raspbian's okay. Easier to maintain.
Yeah, that's fair.
As always, thank you to all of our patrons, but especially our executive producer level patrons, Jacob Chappell, Andrew Cotton, and David Allen. Without all of your all support, we wouldn't still be making the podcast. So thank you all so much. We would just be having these conversations in Discord, and it would be just for us, and
that's right.
Be completely wasted. So we appreciate you all a bunch. And thanks to Julian for doing transcripts every week for the show.
Yes. Yeah, that stuff's awesome.
If you have friends who are deaf or hard of hearing and you think that they would be interested in the show, you can share it with them. The transcripts are available at techpod.content.countdown. There's a big transcripts button there, and we have them for like the last seven episodes now, I think. So that is awesome. And if you like them, please let us know so we keep doing them, because like if nobody uses them, we're probably going to not, But if anybody's finding them useful, we would like to know.
Yeah.
Sure. And I guess that's it for us.
Yeah.
We'll
fire up some GL Quake.
I kind of want to. Yeah. Can we play some GL Quake?
Is the master server still up? I don't know.
I don't think. I think we can just, like, I know your IP. You know my IP. We can put our IPs together. And
that's true.
The question is, who gets the ping advantage? I don't know. I'm happy to host. That's all I'm saying.
We'll have to shoot for it.
Okay. See you all next week. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye. Have a good one.